is I probably ought to have a vein up here to pronounce his name, because all three of his names, his first name, his middle name, and his last name, really need a Scandinavian tongue rather than a German tongue, which is up here right now. But I'll do the best I can. But his middle name is spelled A-A-B-Y-E. And I think for anybody other than someone who lives on herrings, that's a unpronounceable name. But it's something like Abye, something like that. But anyway, his first name is Søren Abye Kierkegaard. He was born on the 5th of May in 1813 in Copenhagen, Denmark, the youngest of seven children. His father was a very wealthy retired merchant who was 56 years old when Kierkegaard was born. And his mother had been a servant girl in the home at the time when his father's first wife died. His first wife, I think, was mother of the first five children. His father married the servant girl less than a year after his first wife had died. And 5 months later, Kierkegaard's next older brother, was born. His father was a stern, strongly moral man with an inclination toward melancholia, and he felt extremely guilty about what had happened. This was one of the strongly influential factors in the father's life. The other one was when he was 11 years old, was a shepherd boy living on the Jutland Heath, which is one of the most desolate places on earth. And he was tending sheep there, and he was suffering from cold and hunger at the time, and he cursed God. And for the rest of his life, he felt that God was punishing him for having cursed God. He thought he was guilty of sin against the Holy Ghost and that he was unforgivable. Two of his children died in childhood, and between 1832 and 1834, three more of his children and his wife died. Father was quite interested in philosophy. He was very influential in Copenhagen. He was one of the distinguished citizens, and many men of talent and knowledge were in his home. And so consequently, the children had a very cultured childhood experience. The home was very much father-centered, and the children identified with the father, both the boys and the girls, identified with the father and were very close, had very strong feelings toward him, which sometimes were expressed positively and sometimes negatively in hostility, but at any rate, they had very, very strong feelings of attachment to their father. The mother, both the first mother and the second mother, apparently were pleasant women, but undistinguished and very little influence on the children. The household, as you might have expected, was very strongly religious. Kierkegaard attended a distinguished school in Copenhagen called the School of Civic Virtue. When he graduated from the school, the rector described him as of good intelligence and interested in unusual things, but childish and lacking in seriousness most of the time. Kind of interesting. And some of his classmates' comments about him also are extant. Well, he was described as generally bright, but not the brightest in the school. He was a bit of a tease, and he often got in fights as a result of his teasing. Came from a strange, funny, gloomy house. And this was his classmates' impression of his home that he lived. Okay, he attended the University of Copenhagen, began in October of 1830, and the University of Copenhagen, like most of the great universities of Europe, was completely Hegelian. Kierkegaard was strongly influenced by Hegel. He became an anti-Hegelian, and yet, like Hegel, he was dialectical. He used Hegelian dialectic even when he didn't realize he was. And he was an idealist, as was Hegel. After his first year in the university, he successfully passed the exams which qualified him to specialize in a discipline. This was highly unusual, so it showed that he was rather bright. He chose theology. And for the next 10 years, he was a theology student. Put that in quotes. He was a theology student. Because he kind of messed around, and he was involved in all sorts of things. And he really studied very little theology. Of the coursework which he took, most of it was history or philosophy. And he was quite active in university social affairs and in student politics. One of the things that I found very remarkable in my study of Kierkegaard, which has led me in some different directions from many of the people that I know who are interested in Kierkegaard, I have been particularly struck with how conservative a person Kierkegaard was in his thought. And certainly quite different from the popular image that we have and that the Danes had of him at the time. One of his close friends at the university was Hans Christian Andersen, who was also interested in social change. And the king of Denmark, King Christian VIII, became concerned about things going on, and there was a great deal of student unrest in the universities, and he asked that students be sent to him so he could talk with them about, you know, how students felt about things and so on. And one of the students who was sent to talk with him to express student feelings was Kierkegaard. And he became a pretty good friend of the king, which is kind of interesting. He wrote some political articles when he was a student. And one of the strange things about Kierkegaard, who in many ways is a strange person, but one of the strange things about him is that politically, his entire life, he was a political conservative. Not a political liberal or a leftist, he was a political conservative. He was a monarchist. And, you know, you wouldn't associate that with the popular image you have of Kierkegaard. Okay. From 1830 to 1836, he was the eternal student. He would sample this course and that course, and, you know, this was the time when he was sort of getting his head straight. He really didn't know what he wanted. He was having a great time. He spent a lot of time drinking Danish beer and getting acquainted with co-eds and non-co-eds and things of that sort, a kind of a campus activist. 1835 to 1837, he had almost completely given up going to the university. He was living beyond his means. He built up large debts. He stayed up half the night and slept most of the day. And this was his aesthetic stage. Aesthetic, as he describes aesthetic stage. He had left home because of a disagreement with his father. In 1837, his father, embarrassed what was going on and wanting a reconciliation with his son, was influential in getting him to come back home again, paid off his debts, and there was a sort of reconciliation, which was fortunate because his father died the following year. Died on the 8th of August, 1838, in agony, deathly afraid of dying. And died an extremely difficult death. Kierkegaard was present and was profoundly influenced by the agony and desperation of his father as he died. He fell in love with a young lady whom he called Regina, the queen. Fell desperately in love with her. Now here he's an aging university student. She was 14 years old. That's Kierkegaard's great love affair that you've heard about. She was 14 years old. He waited for 3 years until she was almost 18, and then he courted her, and they became engaged. They had scarcely gotten engaged when he began to have second thoughts, to reevaluate the importance of his bachelorhood, among other things. And 2 months later, he was successful in convincing her that they couldn't make a go of it in marriage, and so she broke the engagement. He went to Berlin. He always retreated to Berlin whenever he had problems. He went to Berlin, and he wrote the first two of his great books, Either Or and Two Edifying Discourses, which were sort of reflections on what had happened to him. Now, Kierkegaard is the father of existentialism, and one of the characteristics of an existentialist is that you can learn almost as much about his thought from his life as from what he writes. You know, he lives his philosophic position. He doesn't just write it, you know, and then is another person, but he is what he writes. And so he goes through a kind of psychoanalysis of what had gone on, only he kind of universalizes it as this is the way life is for man. He was having a terrific time in Berlin, feeling sorry for himself because he had renounced the possibility of happiness with Regina. You know, and he's sitting there enjoying that melancholia and feeling very, very sorry for himself as the suffering lover who has renounced an impossible love. And word comes to him that Regina is engaged to be married to another guy. Well, that can really blow any balloon you build. So, at any rate, that ended that. She was engaged to a good friend of his named Fritz Schlegel. You know, Fritz Schlegel. Not even what's a good male romantic name? Fritz Schlegel. It's like John Smith, only worse. Fritz Schlegel. You know, how bourgeoisie middle class can you get? We're engaged to Fritz Schlegel. Here she had Søren Kierkegaard. Now she settled for Fritz Schlegel. See. So he has his hero commit suicide in his right. You know, he just couldn't take that. Okay. Schlegel had a rather distinguished career in his own right in politics. He, 1855, he became the governor of the Dutch West Indies and apparently did a rather good job of it. Kierkegaard apparently never had any particularly strong feelings for any other women the rest of his life, because when he died in 1855, he willed his entire estate to Regina. Now, his entire estate didn't amount to much. What mainly it amounted to was unpublished manuscripts of books, because he was about out of money. And this was rather embarrassing for Regina. I mean, her husband is a distinguished diplomat and government official, and a guy dies and wills his estate to his one true love, her. It can be a little embarrassing. Well, she rejected the offer, and yet her husband died a few years later, and her husband had scarcely died when she assumed responsibility to supervise the translation of his works into German. And his reputation really took off as people in Germany began to read his works. She died in 1904, and to the end of her life, she both managed the publication of his works, the translation into various languages, and also protecting his good name. Okay. Between 1843 and 1853, he wrote about 45 books. 10 years. He wrote about 45 books. You know, not little mini, you know, 50, 60, 70 page things. They were all big, full-size books, and some of them bigger ones. So a tremendous outpouring of rhetoric. Now, Kierkegaard was one of those kind of guys that believes that more can be said in 100 words than in 10. You know, and was never averse to using a lot of words if he could do it. So he tends to be rather wordy. He uses oftentimes almost a sort of stream of consciousness style, but it's a control thing. It's not just letting the thing flow and you write it down on paper, but it's a carefully crafted and constructed sort of thing. And so it's sort of like a thinking on paper sort of structure, where he'll dissect an idea and work an idea over, and you know, you watch his mind working there on paper. But it's not just Kierkegaard's mind, but it's the human mind at work. And this takes a lot longer than just to say, this is the way it is, and this is the way it is, and this is the way it is. But there's no awareness of the process of how the conclusion's got arrived at. Okay. He had 1837 shifted from the first stage of his life, the aesthetical stage, to the ethical stage. In 1848, he had moved from the ethical stage to the religious stage. Now I'll be explaining all three of these as we go along. But anyway, at Easter time in 1848, he felt that he had reached the climax of his religious struggle, his effort to get beyond life as purely ethical. And entered on the third stage of life, the religious. This created a problem for him. He now felt that he was a Christian. He suspected that perhaps he was the only living Christian, and that he was living in a completely pagan, institutionalized bourgeoisie world. You have to bear in mind that in the 19th century, in the middle of the 19th century, in most anywhere you went in Europe, the state church had pretty well reached rock bottom in terms of any kind of vitality. It was purely a bureaucratic structure which was kept moving by its own momentum and taxes. But it lacked any kind of life or vitality, and it was, you know, strictly conventional and traditional. And it was against this sort of thing that he was rebelling. His problem was, should he publish the conclusions which he had reached, that perhaps he was the only living Christian? He was never averse to a fight. He enjoyed fights. Well, one of the things that would happen would be that it would cut him off from the institutional church, and he'd never be a clergyman. But he now had passed his exams, and he was eligible to be a clergyman and get an assignment to a parish. And since he came from a rather well-to-do, well-known family, and you know, politics being what they are, he likely would have gotten a pretty cushy parish. Should he go along with the institutional church, or should he, you know, publish what he thought he had reached? Well, this period of indecision in his own personal religious stage went from about 1848 to 1852. And at that point he concluded he couldn't keep silent anymore. The church, which he called Christendom, as opposed to Christianity, which is true Christian church. Christendom, or the established church, was so bad that someone was going to have to speak out against it. Well, first he published a couple of things under a pseudonym, and then finally he published things under his own name. As a result of his polemic against the institutional church of Denmark, the church got angry with him. The newspapers got angry with him. Everybody got angry with him in Denmark. The country of Denmark publishes a little 35-page summary of Kierkegaard's life, which is rather well done. And near the end of it comments that at the time when Kierkegaard was born, the word Søren was the most popular name for a boy in Denmark. When Kierkegaard died, nobody was naming their son Søren. And that's the effect he had on Denmark. But he attacked the organized church. He said, Christendom is a conspiracy against the Christianity of the New Church, of the New Testament. He wrote a very concentrated attack from December of 1854 to October of 1855. He wrote letters to newspapers. He published tracts. He attacked the hierarchy of the church. He attacked the clergy. He attacked the complacent laity. He engaged in unconventional religious behavior and attacked some of the traditional doctrines of the church. The 2nd of October in 1855, he was returning home from the bank with the last money that he possessed. Now, Kierkegaard never was gainfully employed in his life. When his father died, his father left him independently wealthy, quite wealthy. Kierkegaard was, after his high living college days, was rather frugal with his money and with his, and didn't spend a great deal of it and lived rather modestly. But he expended his money on publishing his books. The people didn't stand in line to publish him. So he had to publish his own books. Now his books sold rather well. But book publishing game, you know, in theology and philosophy, is not such that you're going to become independently wealthy writing books. And so his money was gradually disappearing, and the last several years of his life, he was worried a great deal about how he was going to make ends meet when his money ran out. Now, he knew how unpopular he was, and he could imagine how the people in Denmark would feel if Kierkegaard went bankrupt. You know, everybody sit there and laugh at him and watch him starve to death. And so he was very concerned about what he was going to do. Well, at any rate, the 2nd of October 1855, as he was returning home from the bank with the last of his money, he had just closed out his account. He fell unconscious on the main street of Copenhagen, and he was taken to the hospital. When he recovered consciousness, he was paralyzed from the waist down. He thought that it was the result of a spine deformity which he had suffered as a child when he fell out of a tree. He lacked any more incentive to live, and he just kind of wasted away in the hospital, died on the 11th of November in 1855. One of his childhood friends, a pastor Bazin, attended him pastorally in his last days, but happened to be, ironically, out of town the day when he died. And so he died alone and friendless in the hospital. He wanted to have communion before he died, but he refused to receive communion from a state employee. And of course, every clergyman was a state employee. You know, he had a state church, so they were state employees. He would not take communion from a state employee. On the other hand, Bazin wouldn't let anybody else administer communion to him, and so he died without communion. And he died very much at peace, surprisingly enough. He died on a Sunday, another little irony. He died on a Sunday, very much at peace. And the basis for his being at peace seems to have been his great concern that his money would not last, you know, was over and done with. He had been taken care of. His money had lasted just long enough for his life. You know, now he could go. He was buried the following Sunday. There are all kinds of fascinating little ironies about the death of Kierkegaard. He was buried the following Sunday from the Cathedral Church of Our Lady, which was the university church and the largest church in Copenhagen. The dean of the chapel officiated at the funeral. Somebody during the course of the week goofed, and nobody really knows, because they really didn't want to bury him from that church, and certainly the dean didn't want to perform the funeral. But all of a sudden, there they were stuck. It was from that church, the dean was scheduled to do it, and they couldn't think of any graceful way to get out of it.
Sunday?
Yeah, and on Sunday, sure, on the following Sunday, Sunday afternoon, his older brother Peter, who was a pastor at a small town outside Copenhagen, delivered the eulogy. Kierkegaard, although he was unpopular with the populace and the clergy and the government, was very popular with the student body, as sometimes happens, right? He was very popular with the student body at the University of Copenhagen. And they were not invited to the funeral. Well, that didn't bother them. They came anyway. So there were students sitting on one side of the cathedral. You can imagine, this great big cathedral. There's a whole bunch of students sitting there, you know, in their student togs and so on, kind of restless and talking to one another, you know. First time anybody'd seen him in church in years. And there's a whole student body sitting there, and Kierkegaard's their hero. Over on the other side is the establishment, who are there because, after all, regardless of what sort of a person he was, he is a Kierkegaard, you know, and the Kierkegaards are important in Denmark. So they're there to honor the Kierkegaard name. And they're the students sitting on the other side. And the boys up front are afraid there's going to be a riot before the service is over. Well, Peter was successful in keeping them, you know, from fighting one another. When they got to the cemetery, the dean began the committal service. And this was more than the students could take. So they shoved the dean aside. Kierkegaard's nephew, Henry Lund. So if any of you are from Lund family, come from a distinguished family, protesters. His nephew, Henry Lund, stepped up to the grave and asked, by what right the establishment thought it could bury Kierkegaard? And then he read the passage from the book of Revelation where St. John says that the angel says to the church of Laodicea that God would spew it from his mouth because, you know, it was neither hot nor cold. And he quoted passages from Kierkegaard's last pamphlet, and somehow or other, amongst all of that stuff going on, they buried Kierkegaard. So he was very influential on Husserl, the father of phenomenology. He was very influential on Friedrich, a great influence on Friedrich Nietzsche, who in turn had a great influence on Sigmund Freud. Strongly influenced Heidegger, Jaspers, Sartre, Barth, Karl Heim, and a whole host of other people. And he's still influential in continental theology and philosophy and American philosophy. Okay, now, to make things a little bit easier for you as we get into the philosophic section, on each of the three stages, I will give you 7 items that will be compared and contrasted with one another in the 3 stages. Number 1, what is the basic psychological aspect that is the primary moving factor in the situation to shape that kind of life? Secondly, a paradigm model from history or from literature of someone who epitomized that kind of life. Pardon me. Second is basic concepts for that kind of life. Thirdly, a paradigm. Fourthly, the goal of that stage of life. Fifthly, that life's view of what life is. Sixthly, the stage of development that is represented by that stage. And seven, the consequence which comes as a result of being at that stage of life. Now, until one gets into the religious life, all prior stages are unsatisfactory. And as a result, any individual who is at a particular stage of life prior to the religious stage of life will either be moved to attempt to find a kind of life which is more satisfying and beyond that kind of life, or will, you know, stay at that level of psychological development but be very frustrated by it. Kierkegaard is one of a great many people since David Hume and Immanuel Kant who have attempted to do philosophy by taking a psychological approach, attempting to explain all the essential questions about life in psychological terms, or in terms of how the human mind operates or how the human life develops. Okay, we have one thing left to do on the ascetical yet, and that is the banquet. In one of the most charming sections in the second treatise which Kierkegaard wrote, two edifying discourses. Recall, the first one was either or, and the second one was two edifying discourses, both written at the time that he had fled to Berlin after his unsuccessful effort at getting married. There's a charming little story about a banquet. There are five men who are friends of one another. They get together very frequently, and they conceive of the idea of a perfect banquet. What would a perfect banquet be like? Now, what Kierkegaard is working from is a famous dialogue of Plato called The Symposium, where on the evening after the finals of the tragedy competition in the Athens area, where Socrates' young friend Agathon had won the competition, he was the best tragedian of the year, they happened to meet at his house and decided to get together and, you know, and eat and drink a little bit, not drink enough so they didn't know what they were doing, dispense with the dancing girls and the music and just talk. And they would take turns speaking on a common topic to exhibit their rhetorical excellence. And they talked on the topic of love. And so they're kind of thinking about that, and it was kind of a spontaneous event, which turned out a very exciting event for them. And so they were talking about the possibility of doing something like that. And then it sort of got dismissed by both of them as, well, you know, well, if you're a writer, you can write this sort of thing, but it wouldn't really happen. A few days later, everyone gets an invitation to a dinner written by one of the group. And what happens then is a description of how it turned out and the speeches everybody gave and so on. And it's a redoing of, in a sense, of the kind of a Danish symposium. And without smorgasbord. And it is done in this way. They receive an invitation. They are each picked up at their home by a rented carriage. The blinds are down on the side of the carriage so they can't see where they're going, although they shortly realize that they're being carried out into the country somewhere. It's a country, and they finally reach there. The driver throws open the door. They're right at the entrance to a country inn where they've never been before. They come inside. Their host greets them there. He takes them upstairs to a private room, throws open the door,
The throwing open of the door is an automatic signal for a little string orchestra to begin playing Mozart. The table is all set. They sit down. The meal immediately begins to be served. And so you see, you have a happening occurring. And it just bang like that. And all of a sudden, you're right in the middle of it. Now, it's been carefully organized ahead of time by the host. But he arranges it in such a way that the temperature is just right, the light's just right, it's the right mix of company, it's the right food, it's the right background music. Everything is just right. They then take turns giving speeches, and they get done with their speeches they get done with the meal just at midnight, and then they begin their speeches. When they get done with the speeches, the host calls for a closing libation, and they bring out a special wine. Each one's glass is filled. He drinks a toast to the group, smashes his glass against the door, to signal the end of the event. Then they're ushered quickly downstairs. The coachman is waiting for them. Their host bids them farewell and tells them they will be carried a mile away from here, and there are five carriages waiting, one for each of them to take them to wherever they want to go, go back to their everyday life. And that's the banquet. Well, this is an aesthetic moment, and everything that was done, everything that was arranged, was oriented to the idea of a once-in-a-lifetime type experience. And it gives you, and you can see now why this stage is called aesthetical. Because the focus is upon aesthetic excellence. And what makes the experience valuable or not valuable is whether it is aesthetically satisfying or not. And you can see also that a great deal of effort and energy and money can go into leading this kind of life, leading a life which is, let's say, culturally satisfying, and having one's whole existence oriented around a kind of aesthetic satisfaction. And a great many distinguished people live this way. All right, this is the aesthetic stage now. The 7 points about it, because I'll start going down them again as we get into the ethical, just to remind you. 7 points about it is the basis for this kind of life is the erotic side of our personality, the emotional side of our personality. The basic values are pleasure and pain. The paradigm model is Don Juan. The goal of this kind of life is the pursuit of pleasure, with the awareness that the pursuit will usually be more pleasant than the satisfaction. The conception of what life is like tends to get to be that life is kind of an irony, or life is a sort of joke, that it is empty and meaningless, and consequently, you get what kicks you can out of it, and you don't complain when you don't get them. In an interesting kind of sense, the point where Kierkegaard begins is the point where Nietzsche ends in his philosophic thinking, and Nietzsche's philosophic thinking went through a progression. But Nietzsche, who was younger than Kierkegaard, because Kierkegaard died in 1855 and Nietzsche was born in 1844, Nietzsche begins aesthetic in a more of a purist kind of aesthetic sense, but Nietzsche pretty well ends up where Kierkegaard begins on the first stage. The stage of development, if we would compare this with the way human beings develop, this is rather childish level of development, or it's the kind of level of development which we identify with childhood, where the child tends to lead a sort of self-centered existence. He's not very strongly animated toward responsibility to other people, Matter of fact, he doesn't really want to assume responsibilities. He wants to play and have a good time and so on. The consequence to the human being who remains at this stage of development and tends not to progress beyond it is a kind of melancholy and despair, a feeling of hopelessness about life, which tends to arise from boredom and from the fleetingness of life. Because if life is based on moments of pleasure, on happenings, and every happening has a certain period of euphoria after it, you know, the afterglow of the event, and then there's a kind of a deadness after it, a kind of a, you know, you feel sort of emotionally hungover. And life then gets to be this way. And you see life as a progression of moments, of high points and low points, but moving on very, very rapidly. There's no continuity to it. It's always very insecure. And you see life is quite insecure. And finally you reach a point where you figure, you know, what's the use? It's just not worth it. And so consequently, most people then attempt to move on to do something beyond this. And this is what Kierkegaard calls the ethical. Now on the aesthetic level, we are dealing there with life lived as immediacy, where one, it's a kind of a spontaneity between the individual and his situation. When we move on to the ethical now, he calls this life as finitude. The individual living on the aesthetic level really has no limits. Anything goes if it's going to work. There are no limits to what he can do or what he may do or what he may want to do. It depends on the moment, the situation, what he does. And the goal is pleasure, satisfaction, and so consequently there are no prohibitions. At the same time, there are no commands to do anything. And so there's an openness, and there's a kind of infinity here. By virtue of the fact that there's a kind of an openness and a kind of infinity, a person who lives on the level of the aesthetic never develops a character, never develops a personality, never becomes different from other people. And so if you've met one playboy, you've met them all, right? You've met one playgirl, you've met them all. One is just like the next one. Some years ago in the 40s and 50s, we used to have the beautiful people, you know, the jet set. Today, I think they're the geriatric set. But we had the beautiful people. Well, and you know, and every once in a while, one of them would appear on a talk show like Jack Parr's show back in those days. And one was like the next one. They looked different. But one was as vapid as the next one. You were impressed by the first one, and by the time the third one was on, they all said the same thing. They all talked the same way. They all had the same cliches. They all were lovely emptinesses. I always had a kind of an empty cocoon feeling with them. You know, there sits that lovely grayish cocoon, but there's a little hole in the side, and you look in, there's nothing left inside of one. The butterfly's gone. And so they're just kind of vapid. And you attempt to get at their personality, and they don't have any. There's nothing inside. Many actors and actresses are this way, primarily because they are whatever role they happen to be playing right then. And with the dominance of television today, and with one of the sources of income being appearance on talk shows, one of the things that agents are very busy with their clients is figuring out the sort of thing, to use their expression, to use the sort of thing they're going to be into when they appear on this show or appear on that show. And so you'll have some famous actress appearing on a show, and she's gung-ho about this sort of thing. And, you know, so she talks animatedly about this sort of thing. Well, the next time she's on, she's into something else. And she talks animatedly about that sort of thing. Well, this is her script. If you put her on coal, she wouldn't have a thing to say, because she isn't anybody. She's strictly a lot of roles and potential roles. And that's all that there is to her. That's all that there is to him. There is nothing about them that is them. And when they are between roles, they're very dull and nothing. And when they're in a role, well, you know, that's what they are. They're completely surface. And so that there, many of them are at a kind of a pre-ethical aesthetic sort of stage, and this is the nature of their existence also. This is the nature of the acting profession. You go from job to job, don't you? And sometimes it's a year between jobs. And when you score big. But as you're coming to the end of your run, you know, then the ulcers are starting to form as you hope there's another job after that one's done. And you know that you can be big smash success today, and a year from now, nobody knows who you are. They've forgotten you. That's the nature of the profession. So it is a very aesthetic, in Kierkegaard's sense, a very aesthetic kind of profession. And it produces that kind of person. You can't organize it and regulate it. And even if you got a long-term contract and you're doing a situation comedy and it's on, you know, for half the year and then reruns, just like that, in mid-season, the public can lose interest in you and you're done. And so it's a very, very insecure life, and the only kind of value and meaning that occurs in it is when you're making it big, when there's a happening. Okay, well, nobody likes to live that way, including actors and actresses, right? We'd like to get steady employment. We'd like to have life mean something more than that. And so consequently, what tends to happen then is people will move beyond this to the ethical level. They will move from sheer subjectivity of relationships and attempt to get their life on a more objective base, a more lasting, reliable, dependable base. They want their life to be more dependent on something more than values that they have come up with. They want something they can depend on, they can be sure about. And so consequently, people will turn from their feelings, their guts, their spontaneous responses to situations, to their intelligence. And they will attempt to figure out what life is all about. And so consequently, our point number one, the basis of the ethical life, is the rational. Now, a given individual may for a while gravitate between the aesthetical and the ethical life. And as you find the aesthetical life beginning to lose its attractiveness, you can sort of see forward into the ethical life, and there are certain things about the ethical life that look attractive to you that didn't before. When you're a young teenager, the idea of doing like your dad does and getting up at 7:30 in the morning and taking the commuter train into the city and, you know, 3 weeks off a year for vacation plus a few long weekends and year after year after year after year, what a drag, right? This is the young aesthete reacting to the ethical. But then after a while, you know, you'd like to have this and you'd like to have that, and you met her and she's really great, and, you know, boy, you cannot maintain an aesthetic marriage. It's not very long. You can live on love for, I guess, maybe 5 days, and then you get pretty hungry. And then the landlord is rapping for the rent. So you just can't stay that way anymore. You can fiddle all summer long while the ant works, but then comes autumn and you better have your food supply in for the winter or you aren't going to make it. See, so for most people, except children of extremely wealthy parents, the ethical life starts calling sooner or later. And Kierkegaard says, as you get to that point, as you gravitate between the two, and the wish you could stay in the ascetical, and know you got to go into the ethical, you got to settle down and make something of yourself, and we'll take that quite literally in Kierkegaard. He says, you, for a time, there's a sort of an equilibrium state, where the urge of the ascetical and the demand of the ethical are kind of evenly balanced. And so you're balanced between the two, and you just kind of hang there. You know, and that's where we say nowadays, you go through a kind of period of getting your head straight, figuring out what you're going to do. That's the equilibrium stage, is you're moving from the one to the next one. And were you trying to get it to come clear so that you can get it straight? And you do a lot of what? Thinking, right? You do a lot of thinking. The rational takes over. You don't do a lot of figuring out ways to satisfy your yens. You start thinking about what life's all about, what your role in life can be. You know, if you're a religious person, you may think about what God wants, has in mind for you to do. Now, we're going to hit, I probably should mention at this point, the third stage we'll get into tomorrow is the religious stage. But it is perfectly possible for one to be religious in another sense, be a Christian at any of these three stages, or to be a pagan at any of these three stages. Now, I have my doubts as to whether Kierkegaard's sense of the religious, one can be other than Christian and get to the religious stage. I suspect that one may get to the portal of the religious stage, but no farther, if one is not a Christian. But with respect to the aesthetical, you can be an aesthetical Christian, you can be an ethical Christian, and you can also make Christian idolatry out of aestheticism and make Christianity kind of a pleasure principle. Gobs of people have reduced Christianity to an ethical system, and that's one of the biggest problems that we've always got. I'll talk a bit about tomorrow. But at any rate, there comes the need to have something more than just the momentary pleasures of life. Life has to have a better basis than that. And so the rational begins to take over. The basic concepts with which one operates on the ethical level tend to be good and evil. Remember, with aesthetic was pleasure and pain. That which one was drawn to is the pleasant, that which one fled from was the painful. We move into the ethical life. That which one is drawn to is the good, that which one flees from is the bad, is the evil. The paradigm model for the ethical is Socrates. Now, there are a number of reasons why Kierkegaard chose Socrates as his model here. Number one, Socrates tells us through Plato that as a young man he was trained in the sciences. The sciences were the first varieties of philosophy. All the pre-Socratics were scientific thinkers. And He discovered that there were just gobs of different schools of thought about what science is, about what is real, and they didn't agree with one another, and one guy sounded as good as the next guy did, which means that one guy sounded as bad as the next guy did, and every guy claimed he was right and everybody else was wrong. So he figured the scientists were never going to get it off the ground, and he was pretty right, because it took them 2,000 more years before they did. But so he thought, he got more interested in ethics, the good life. What is the life which is right for man? Or what sort of life is best for a man to live? And he devoted all of his interest and concern to ethics. Now, Plato, his pupil, was considerably broader in his interests than that. Well, he uses Socrates as his general character in his dialogues. From Plato and from other sources, we're pretty well convinced that Socrates just asked the question, what is the good life? What sort of life is the best life for a human being to live? And so he is, you know, the man who has been disillusioned by the aesthetic life, seeking to formulate and structure the ethical life. The essence of ethics is to place oneself under universal rules, under rules which hold for all people. For a rule to be an ethical rule, it must hold across the board. It can't be good for you, but not good for me. That's aesthetical. You may get turned on by vanilla ice cream, and I get turned on by tutti frutti. See, that's aesthetic. But it's not, you get turned on by speaking honestly to people, but I get turned on by lying. And so speaking honestly is your good, and lying is my good. See, that doesn't work, does it? See, so we're in the area of ethics, where the values have to become, or they're not ethical. And one places oneself under rules, under discipline. One accepts responsibility and duty. One's behavior is determined not by one's feelings, but one's behavior is determined by something out of one's environment, by something outside of oneself. One takes orders from other people. Or one devotes one's life to giving orders to other people. But what I do is determined not by how I happen to feel about things, but by what my responsibilities are, what my duty is, what is good for me to do right now. And so, as you can see, this is a quite different kind of life from the first kind of life. The notion about life which is assumed by the ethical life is that life is a rational structure. Take someone like Cicero, who was probably about as complete an ethical rationalist as you can find. The universe is completely rational. It goes according to regular rules of order. The reason why people have trouble is because their lives are disorderly. What we need to have is an organized, orderly society, which means that we set up good laws, we find the laws which make a society work right, and we live in accordance with them. If I find myself in a situation where I must act and I don't know what to do, I figure it out, and then I do it. Because all of life makes sense. And all I have to do as a human being is to figure it out. Everybody, Cicero says, everybody has intelligence. That's common to all men. This is the basic commonality to human beings. And so the basic rule of ethics is act intelligently. Figure it out. You don't follow your impulses anymore. You don't say, will that be fun to do or will it be a drag? You ask, what would it be intelligent to do? And then you do it. Because you know that's right. Well, what happens when one lives this way. What happens when one lives this way is one becomes a person. One becomes a unique person. We become shaped by the way we act. We no longer are a free spirit floating around here, there, and having no form or structure, but we become a kind of person. We assume responsibilities. We develop habits. Continuities begin to develop. See, and each one of us becomes a unique human being. Without this, we can't become a unique human being. We can't become a person. It is this that distinguishes us from other forms of life.
Sir?
Yes.
I've often wondered if Kierkegaard had gotten married like he should have.
There's an ethical remark.
Would have brought him down to earth and brought him out of this, his theoretical idealism into some practical realities. Have you ever speculated on that?
Well, what you're saying is if Kierkegaard had gotten married, he would have concluded that there was nothing beyond the ethical.
Well, I don't know if I'm saying that. I didn't intend to say that.
But that's the implication of what you're suggesting. You see, what Kierkegaard is saying, finally, is that the religious is very practical. As a matter of fact, it's most practical because it works. And everything else, every other level has bugs and frustrations, and it is only the religious level that does work. But it does not work by means of something you can do. In other words, you can't teach people how to be religious. And you can't put up, construct a system of how to achieve the religious stage or something of that sort. Because when we get to that point, this is where we get divine intervention. And without divine intervention, there's nothing we can do. The best we can do is the ethical level. Now, I think there are some aspects of Kierkegaard's personal life which I think would have been probably considerably improved by marriage. I suspect his marriage with Cordelia might not have been too successful. But with the proper wife, he certainly would not have had exhibited all the eccentricities which he had in his later life. Now, as he got toward the latter part of his life, he began to get obsessed with the idea of personal suffering. And so he began to get pathological. Now, this is my view of Kierkegaard, and not everybody agrees with me. But I think in the last 5 or 6 years of his life, he became pathological. And he began to turn his doctrine inside out. And he came to the conclusion that to be a Christian is to suffer. Now, his doctrine, his earlier doctrine was to be a Christian is to make it. In other words, that the Christian who is in every respect a Christian will be successful in life. Granted that many Christians will be knights of infinite resignation and won't get that far. But under Christianity alone is solving the problem of existence possible. Then he began to get attacked by all sorts of people, and he began to come to the conclusion that to be a Christian is to suffer and to be misunderstood. But then he went back to the Socratic model, and Socrates was attacked by people, and finally executed with general approval in the Athenian state. And he took the various passages in the latter parts of the Gospels where Jesus tells his disciples, men will hate you for my name, and so on. And so he said, to be a Christian is to suffer. If you are not suffering, then what? Then you are not a Christian. Therefore, you got to go out and do something that will cause people to cause you to suffer. So he just plain got obnoxious. See, because he felt the need to suffer. And so he got so that he rejected any kind of human efforts to communicate with him positively. If somebody tried to be a friend to him, you know, slap their hand. Rejected him because he began to take sort of the hermit's direction to life, and a kind of direction which he himself 10 years earlier had rejected as an attempt to ethicize the religious. You create the monastic movement, you know, with the living in the monastery and the steps of things that you do and your stages to holiness. This is ethicizing religion. The idea is that if you do it right and you do it long enough, sooner or later, all of a sudden the heavens will open and you will see God. You will have the beatific visions. Well, this is reducing religion to a system. And it was an effort to try to create the religious system and to make it available for human beings. And he rejected this as a halfway measure and as wrong. But at the end of his life, he was sort of doing the same thing. And he did get rather irrational in his behavior, as well as eccentric.
Well, I've often wondered if either he could have gotten married or have gotten into the priesthood.
Yeah.
He could have been tempered in his extremes and mellowed a little bit, having to deal with reality instead of theory. Mm-hmm. Having to deal with simple people all the time.
Yeah.
He
would have gotten away from so much introversion. Yeah. At the same time, you know, you could say something like that about Freud, and you say, well, you know, Freud would have been one heck of a lot better psychologist if he didn't hang around with mentally ill people so much. And some people have said that, you know, that the trouble with Freudian psychology is that it's based on his study of insane people. Now, if he'd studied normal people, he might come out with something different. So, I suppose that the final evaluation of somebody like Kierkegaard is really, does he help me to understand myself and the world, or doesn't he? That's what a man rises and falls in. Now, what he would have thought, or what he would have been, or what he would have said if he had gotten married and become a Danish Lutheran clergyman in some small town outside Copenhagen. You know, it's who's to say what he would have done or been.
But if he helps you only through your middle age and not to carry you through old age, you find yourself in the predicament that he was in his old age, it's not helping you very much.
No, but the predicament he was in his old age, and he wasn't really that old. I mean, he was sort of early middle age. But the predicament that he ended up in is not consistent with his psychological doctrine. In other words, it is... In his behavior, he began to act contrary to his own principles. So he contradicted his own principles, and from that point on, he ceased to be consistent.
His end was very much conditioned by his particular life, what he had witnessed in his particular father.
I think also he can. It's always fun to read literature that's critical of establishment and see all the names and images that are used and so on. But his last critical works of the Danish state church, almost reached the point of absurdity. And he was, as a creative mind, he was rapidly going downhill. He had produced what he, you know, what was useful, and in the last few years he'd become a propagandist rather than a creative thinker. So his
his best work is in his early and middle works and not so much in his last works. Although it always does the church good to be criticized. Keeps it loose. Keeps it from getting ossified.
Seemed like he couldn't deal with what Paul is talking about, the sin inside of himself. He never found a way, or God didn't reveal to him a way to deal with the old self. And so he just kind of resigned himself to it. There was no power to conquer, which was his motto, the Christian that overcomes the evil or overcomes the problems.
Yeah, in the final analysis, when you get, you know, and every time I've talked about Kierkegaard, I get about the same kind of reaction at this point, you know, because it, gee, it really was terrific for the first stage and the second stage, and boy, all of a sudden, here is going to be the answer to life that I've been looking for, you know, and now I'm going to go home from Holland Village and apply it, and we, you know, and it's clear sailing from here on in. You know, and all of a sudden it's not anything you can do, and it's up to God. You know, and you sort of stop, and then you think about it a little bit, and you say, by golly, I'm trying to operate this thing out of the ethical level, you know, where I'm in charge. Yes, you are nowhere ever more in charge than on the ethical level.
Right. The key word, I think, is relinquishment at that point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and this is what Kierkegaard makes a great deal of, and you struggle. Mm-hmm. And he lists a whole number of stages where you struggle to hang on to the ethical, to hang on to, I'm running my life. Yeah. And you try to twist things to fit your values. You try to twist scripture to fit what you want it to mean. And you interpret it in a certain way, and you try it, and it doesn't work. And then you say, well, heck with the whole business, and that doesn't work. And then you come back and say, Jim, sorry, God, I did it. And then finally, you just give up. And that's when it starts working. Or you find out that you're not going to, you know, you will have to settle for the best you can come up with.
My problems are very much in that same area, the introversion and the singleness. What would Kierkegaard do with his baptism? Or couldn't he appropriate that gift? It seems to me that the difference between Kierkegaard and Luther is that when Luther reached those points of extreme insecurity and inwardness, he had his baptism.
Yeah.
And that I don't find in Kierkegaard. I shouldn't say I don't find. I haven't heard it.
But before I respond to that, may I point out to you that from this point on, you are faced with the ethical choice of listening or drinking. So you don't have to remain. The coffee hour has begun. Okay, Jerry. I think there is a certain element of that. Now bear in mind that what Kierkegaard is doing in all of his writings is writing egocentrically. He is writing from the ego out reflectively. And so consequently, he will be going at the whole business from a personal human standpoint. See, whereas Luther tends to write third person objective about the human being and also about God. And so he approaches it from a different standpoint. Now, when you operate...
But Luther could say, I am baptized, and that's first person, and it's talking about an identity.
Yeah, but now where does he get his security? You know, whether you're talking about baptism or you're talking about the Lord's Supper and you get around to that section in his catechism, where does the security come from? It's not the water that does it. It's not the bread that does it. It's not the wine that does it. It is the Word.
See?
And so he is Word-centered. See, and the Word is outside of him
and he is interacting with it and dealing with it cognitively and non-cognitively, but strongly cognitively, and he has the sure word of God. He also concerns himself a great deal with, you know, why didn't we just get Scripture? Why did we get baptism? Why did we, in particular, why did we get the Lord's Supper? Well, you know, we human beings are so weak. He has a much better understanding of the common man than Kierkegaard does. Maybe that's what you were leading to. Luther has a much better understanding of the common man and his needs. Kierkegaard is an intellectual. And so Luther says, well, you know, God understood us. And, you know, us German peasants, we got to have something we can feel to trust in. So there's that bread we can taste, and there's that wine that we can taste, you know, and as sure as we can taste that, by golly, that surely God loves us and has forgiven us. See, and he tends to emphasize the weakness of our nature and our dependency on God because we are so weak. And it's a personal relationship, whereas Kierkegaard is much more philosophical and concerned with what does it mean? How can you cope with it? And is there some way one can make sense out of existence? Or what levels of reality are there? And so there are agreements and disagreements between them, and ultimately when you get to the points, because you're dealing philosophically with things, it means you're dealing rationally with things. Ultimately, where you get to the points where the payoff is supposed to come, you get a non-rational answer, which is frustrating.
Does he ever deal with the sacraments?
I don't think so. Only indirectly. They aren't really important. What he's most concerned about is that aspect of life where of interaction with God. Internal.
Yeah. His three steps also point to where it seems like a lot of people are now, where they've gone past the rational, but they've gotten into the mystic thing or the drug experience.
Right. That's right.
Man is mystic now.
Yeah, that's right.
Would you say that's kind of stuck in between, or is that going back to the ascetic again?
In some cases it would be going back to the ascetic.
Yeah.
In some cases it would be a kind of perversion where you attempt a...